Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. The impacts of climate change, record high annual temperatures, extreme weather conditions, record droughts, rising seas, warming oceans, and melting ice sheets are plain to see. Last year, over 15,000 scientists wrote an open letter to the globe warning a collision course between humanity and the rest of the natural world if we fail to act. So how do we understand this civilization that we've built and its implications for a livable planet? And how do we grasp our responsibility to the coming generations? In his new book, No Immediate Danger, our guest, National Book Award-winning journalist, novelist, and essayist William Vollman, begins an unsentimental elegy for our doomed, energy-intensive civilization. It's full of the voices of regular people and experts, of scientific data and industry doublespeak, and dark humor. And it's written to the future inhabitants of the hotter, environmentally despoiled Earth we together are creating. Bill Vollman is the author of 10 novels, including Europe Central, which won the National Book Award. He's also written 4 collections of stories, a memoir, and 6 works of nonfiction, including Rising Up and Rising Down, a wide-ranging study of violence, and Imperial, about the Mexican-American border. And I'm very glad to say that Bill Vollman joins me here in the KALW studio. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And I want to let listeners in the Bay Area know that Bill is going to be at Kepler's this evening and also at the East Bay Booksellers in Oakland. Tomorrow evening, we'll have all the details for that at our website, yourcallradio.org, and we'll get into those later in the program as well. So, Bill, this is a really remarkable book. This is the first half of what's going to be a two book series about what you call carbon ideologies.
What a dismal project.
Well, you dived right in. You bring all kinds of resources to it, many voices. And I guess my question to start with is one point in the book where you maybe quote from someone who might not be expected to be in a book about fossil fuels, and that's Theodore Dreiser. And, you know, and you actually quote from Sister Carrie. And I was wondering, Dreiser's somebody who wrote social realism, social criticism in the form of novels. How, you know, is he a model for you or the way you approach this kind of thing? Why do you want to draw on him in this book?
I have lots of models, but one of the many things I like about Sister Carrie is that when you read it, you get to watch people slowly go uphill and downhill, and they don't really see step by step what's happening to them, but we can. And one of the things Dreiser says is that someone might be headed for tragedy, but moment by moment, he's going to think that his life is just fine, and that seems quite appropriate to us and our carbon ideologies. Thank goodness, because why would we want to feel how bad it is?
I think that's really what this book is trying to get arms around. No one wants to face this.
That's right. As I say about Fukushima, we normalize, you know, in order to avoid feeling the pain.
And you talk about. I mean, what's interesting in the book is when you're quoting Dreiser talking about how we see people's tragedies from outside, they may experience them very differently themselves. But in this book, you're writing about a tragedy. Well, actually, if my question is, are we the tragic figures, or it is the people in the future who are going to take on what we've created?
I would say a little bit of both. We don't actually see how we are impoverishing ourselves and our children and so many other organisms on Earth. And as long as we don't see it, it's maybe not that urgent. And once it's all over, of course, it's not urgent either. It's like the way we think about the disappearance of the buffalo from the plains. We don't have to be all up in arms about it because it's too late to do anything.
And how do you think people manage not to see it at this point? I guess that, you know, it's very interesting to hear some of the voices you talk to in the book and how people try to, you know, they compartmentalize, or they say, well, you know, here's some confounding information. But it seems like, you know, you could understand 1977 perhaps going, oh, well, there's just beginnings of understanding of the impact of human beings on the climate. But 2018, it's a lot harder.
I am very sympathetic to global warming deniers. I would like to be one myself because it's really so unpleasant to think about. And one of the most difficult aspects of this whole situation is that until now, most of us have been able to get by through empirical testing of our own senses, through self-education. You know, there was a nice old pastor I interviewed in West Virginia who said, "Yeah, but Bill, you know, when I go up in an airplane and I see all these forests, I ask myself, how could man-made equipment put up enough smoke to make a difference?" And that's totally plausible. So to understand why that could be so, we have to either study math and science or believe math and science talking heads. And talking heads sometimes abuse their powers. You know, here we are in a state that now allows legal and recreational marijuana. I remember as a kid, you know, hearing on the radio, oh, you know, marijuana is such a dangerous drug. It leads to harder drugs. You know, we can't ever legalize that. So why would people necessarily believe experts who are telling them that something bad is going to happen and they should worry? Who can blame them?
And most of us, even people who say, you know, people who accept climate science, that's exactly what we're doing. We're accepting it. We're not actually, very few of us take the time to dig into that science and understand it.
That's right. You know, my old physics book said that there are two interesting characteristics to a scientific hypothesis. One is that it can never be proved. It can only be disproved. The other is that it can predict accurately. So take, for instance, the law of gravity. If I pick up my coffee cup and let go of it, I have good reason to think that it's going to fall. That's the predictive power. But I can't prove that it's always going to fall. And so that's how this climate change science is. Since the 70s, they've been saying, all right, the oceans are going to rise and there is going to be more and more CO2 in the atmosphere. And that's what's happening. That doesn't mean it will always happen. And if it stopped happening, then we'd say, great, let's go back to being climate change deniers.
So you begin this book, or at least kind of first part of this book is a primer that really, I mean, you tell me what your purpose in it was, but to me, it almost seemed like it was trying to in a certain sense, kind of re-enchant what has become this world where we just have energy at our fingertips all the time, all these synthetic materials that we don't even think about that come from fossil fuels, to kind of make us rediscover this stuff that's around us. Actually, I was in the middle of reading your book, had to stop to make dinner, and I was using the food processor.
Oh, it's fine.
And I was realizing, and it made me think about what is this for? What is the pleasure we get from it? And what's really involved in making it happen? Talk a little bit about how you approach that primer part, which I love this. I should let listeners know. In the book, Bill Vollman says, you know, you can skip ahead to page 217 if you don't want to go through all this. But it's actually, I thought it really interesting what you tried to do there.
Oh, well, thanks. You know, I just imagine what it would be like to readers of this book in the future, if there are any, to find out that back in the day, I could wake up and flip on a switch and I could get light. In the nighttime, I could get heat and I could listen to the voices of singers, you know, who were long dead. I could cook, you know, with this magic blue flame. I could hop into a vehicle that would take me wherever I wanted, and I didn't even have to use my radiation meter. You know, how strange and how lucky we are right now. And if only we could have this stuff forever. We all want tomorrow to be better than yesterday. And so demand for electricity will continue to go up until something stops it.
That's the voice of William Vollman. He is our guest today on Your Call. I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar. His new book is No Immediate Danger. It's the first in a 2-volume series called Carbon Ideologies, all about the civilization that we share that has brought us to this place where we are really at a point of no return when it comes to climate change and the impacts that's going to have. We invite you to join the conversation if you read other books by Bill Vollman. He's written many and is well known as a National Book Award winner. Your calls at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us, yourcall@kalw.org. Be interested in your questions for Bill Vollmann. Also, your ideas about how is it we can manage to have so much information about climate change and yet continue to live our lives, many of us largely unchanged, knowing that we might be contributing to it. We welcome your calls, 866-798-8255. One of the things that I thought was really cool about the book was that it brought together information from these very disparate sources. Sometimes in the same paragraph, you'd be reading, as you'd say, from an old physics textbook. You might be hearing, someone from the 19th century talking about, here's what electricity is going to do. Then followed by a quote from Lenin saying, here is how our civilization, really defining element of an industrial civilization, this role that electricity plays. And I think there's this way, like I said, we've almost been like, oh, digital. We're at this digital. It was like, oh, no, electricity. This is still at the heart of what we do. Talk about what you wanted to tell there.
Well, it seems to me, Matt, that we've been riding the same wave since about 1750. That was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. That's when Samuel Johnson said, when people are bored, they'll look for something new. They'll try to get a new kind of toy or a new novelty just to avoid the dreary spells of inactivity. And ever since, we've been trying to improve our lives and we've congratulated ourselves. It's not as if we've done anything wrong. We could blame the fossil fuel complex or capitalism, but that's not really fair. As you pointed out, the communists were also trying to improve life for their people. Trees try to improve lives for themselves. They grow and grow and crowd out other trees. We're not really different from any other living organism, and we shouldn't beat ourselves up for having put ourselves in this very, very dangerous situation. But now what do we do about it?
Now, how do you think about changing, novelty? Giving that up, right? That's just consumerism is one element. We think of it as in terms of like, oh, the retail therapy. But there really is often also just the power of like that food processor, feeling that work, feeling that power, that actually is meaningful to people. And it is in so many things that we do.
That is for sure. And one thing to keep in mind, too, is that if we so-called consumers drastically reduced our own demand for things, it probably wouldn't be sufficient to stop climate change. There was a guy named Gutowski at MIT who I quote quite a bit, and he did a study in 1997 about energy patterns of American lifestyles. The most frugal lifestyle, even more frugal than that of a homeless person, was a high-level Buddhist monk who used something like one-third of the average energy that another American would use. It was still twice the global average. And he concluded that, there's only so much we can do through voluntary reduction because we're living in a system of plastics, of wasteful sheet metal manufacturing, all kinds of things that affect us.
And you've pointed out that the waste you just catalog all these different examples of different industrial processes, different things that have become more efficient, but still a lot of waste in our system.
And people will define waste differently. I'm trying to talk about thermodynamic waste waste related to too many greenhouse gases per unit volume of something or other. But that's not the waste that a lot of people see. There's financial waste. And someone might say, well, Bill, I could stop burning my tires to heat up lime to make cement, and I could use old paper instead. But there aren't so many tires where I live, and therefore it's going to be more expensive, and my competitors are going to be able to produce cement for cheaper than I can. So it would be wasteful for me and also suicidal for me to use a better product in my lime kiln.
So let me ask, one of the things that kind of surprised me actually when I first got this book was that this is the first in a volume about carbon ideologies, and there on the cover is a picture of nuclear cooling plants. Wait a minute, that's not a carbon fuel source. So, and in this first volume, this is one of two volumes, and I know that you're going to be talking about coal and natural gas in your second volume. Why does nuclear fit into a two-volume series about carbon ideologies?
Capitalism and communism are both economic ideologies. All of the four fuels I talk about, nuclear, natural gas, coal, and oil, are ideologies about carbon. Nuclear is the uncola. That's the thing that's going to save us from global warming, theoretically, right? Let's dispose of that one first. It needs quite a bit of fossil-based fuels. You've got to mine your uranium, refine it, enrich it, transport it, and then you need a backup generator for your nuclear power plant. All of those things are fossil-fueled. It was because the fossil-fueled backup generator at Fukushima was not situated high enough that the nuclear plants failed.
And you make the story of Fukushima, and your travels to that part of Japan are a big chunk of this book. Talk about what expectations you went in with, about what you thought you were going to look for and ask people about, versus what that reality was for them, and as you kind of came closer to their perspective by hearing their voices.
Well, I try to remember what Thoreau tells us, that we should never let our knowledge get in the way of what's far more important, which is our ignorance. As long as I remember that I'm ignorant, I have a chance of learning something. So I tried to go to Fukushima with an open mind. And actually what I found there the first time was that the tsunami damage was visually far more horrific than the situation of these recently evacuated towns, where it looked as if people might still almost be sleeping. You would see umbrellas leaning up in the doorways of these shuttered houses, maybe a potted plant just starting to wither, empty streets, and you thought, yeah, maybe in a few hours people will be out there. And I really had to go there over time to see the visual creepiness develop.
So when did you start traveling there? What was the timeline?
I went there a couple weeks after the earthquake tsunami. So they had just started to evacuate people. There was a voluntary and involuntary evacuation. It was sort of these two rings. Later on, they broke them up based on fallout distribution into red, yellow, and green zones. So I went once in 2011, two different periods at 2014, and then again last January.
And so with those visits, you talk about initially just saying, oh, yeah, the actual destruction of the earthquake and the tsunami, that's what really struck you. And it sounds like also what was most powerful for the people in the area. How did that change over the course of your visits?
They would always say, you know, Bill, what is radiation anyway? You know, it makes me itch? No, not really. It's invisible, so why should I worry about it? That's when I started thinking more about climate change, because exactly the way the people treat the radiation over there is the way that we treat rising greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. We think that they might be harmful, but we don't feel any power to do anything about them, and we can't notice them moment by moment. When you go into one of these abandoned towns at Fukushima, you'll see broken windows, ivy growing up over signs, towering pampas grass, and beautiful goldenrod. You can sometimes hear the gruntings of very aggressive radioactive pigs. It's very strange and creepy, silent, occasionally beautiful, and so disturbing. But if you're not in that area, you're not even going to think about it.
And so what did you try to then, as you see that disjuncture You know there. You know. I mean, one thing you talk about in the book is your is it dosimeter? Is that how you say it?
Yes.
You carry with you?
Yeah, that's right. A dosimeter you put, you know, in your pocket or something, and that measures your accrued dosage. So you say, all right, once I get this much radiation, I'm out of here. And then you also have a scintillation meter, a pancake frisker.
Yeah, you have to break these tools down. As I was reading even, I got a little confused. So
that,
yes.
That's
oh,
right.
You have
well,
it with you.
Yeah, here's a special guest, just so everyone can hear what it sounds like. That's the frisker right there. And I don't know if you can hear it starting to chitter a little bit.
Yeah.
Very low radiation here, I'm happy to say.
Glad we brought you someplace relatively safe. So you were carrying these different devices to measure both what kind of radiation load for you personally, and then also at any given moment what kind of radiation was in the area.
That's right. At first, I didn't realize that I needed a frisker as well. So I had the dosimeter, and it didn't tell me as much as I wanted to. I would have to stay in the area and see, oh, in this hour, I've accrued this much, so that's, say, 72 times as much radiation as in Tokyo. With the frisker, you can actually go up to some drain pipe or weed and say, oh, you know what? This is really dangerous. Let me stand over here, and now it's much, much safer.
And I thought it was fascinating, the thing that you talked about, that over time in a lot of areas, the what might seem like the ambient level of radiation seemed to have dropped, but what it really is that it had dissipated into different parts of that local environment.
That's right. The half-life of the contaminant of concern, which is the cesium-137, is a little over 30 years. And if you do the math of dividing something by half 10 times, you'll see that it takes about 10 half-lives to get it down to a thousandth of the peak radioactive strength. So we're looking at something like 300 years before all the cesium is gone. In these towns, you'll see massive evidence of decontamination, these horrid black bags everywhere where they strip off the topsoil and so forth, and they have remediated quite a bit. But I measured one house that had been decontaminated in the spring of 2014, and in the fall, the street right in front of it was much worse than it had been before, evidently through rain or wind. The cesium sinks into the soil. It goes into the streams. And the government says, hey, you know, we can't do anything about the forests. We can't chop those down. And any body of water that's a meter deep or more is going to act as a neutron shield. So we'll just leave this stuff there. It's not great. It's a continuing nightmare.
And so I do want to get – I want to follow up on this. And I also want to hear about how attitudes towards nuclear power have or haven't changed in Japan.
Okay.
And specifically in Fukushima, where people – certainly have had people – their consciousness must have been raised regardless of whether they want to really confront those realities. We're talking today with William Vollmann, author of No Immediate Danger, volume one of his two-volume Carbon Ideology series, talking about nuclear power, talking also about coal, oil, and natural gas, and about the civilization that is so energy-intensive and dependent on synthetic materials that come from fossil fuels that are part of this whole world that we live in that contributes to climate change, and how we as a society face that reality and as we as individuals face that reality. Bill is going to be speaking tonight at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park, if you want to catch him then. Also at the East Bay Bookstore in Bookstore Bay, East Bay tomorrow. We'll have more after this.
Listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org. Or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11 1A. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We do podcast the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there. And always send us your ideas and your input on what you'd like to hear on the program at yourcall@kalw.org. Tomorrow, our subject is going to be data monopolies, information monopolies, talking about the mega corporations that make their livings off collecting and trading our personal information, asking whether data privacy regulation would be enough or whether we need to talk about some 21st century trust busting. That's on tomorrow's Your Call. Today, we're in conversation with William Vollman, Bill Vollman. Good to have him here, author of No Immediate Danger, Volume 1 of Carbon Ideologies. His two-part work that he is writing about, that he has written about our carbon-rich world, our energy-intensive civilization, and how we understand our place in it. The number to call if you want to join the conversation, 866-798-8255. We're going to go to calls in just a moment, but I wanted to follow up with you, Bill, talking about Fukushima and Japan, nuclear power there. How has consciousness changed about nuclear power, whether it's at kind of the top levels of Japanese decision-making or on the ground in the places that were affected by that disaster?
You know, there is still a weekly nuclear protest outside the prime minister's residence, but most Japanese are tired of the issue and want to move on, as human beings would be. You know, we Americans don't generally realize that the nightmare at Fukushima is continuing, that every day several tons of radioactive water continues to leak into the Pacific Ocean. And, you know, the Japanese don't really want to think about it either. Who can blame them?
We have a caller on the line, Wayne from San Mateo. Wayne, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, Bill. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I hope I get a chance to meet you tonight.
Oh, thank you, Wayne.
My question, my problem is, I really love the way you're approaching this. I saw the court tutorial up in San Francisco where the judge also had a climate change tutorial, and I found the oil companies trying to get away from being responsible. The problem is it's so pervasive, no one sees this. I try to get people to understand this by talking about Meltwater Pulse 1A. Are you familiar with that?
No, tell me about it.
Meltwater Pulse 1A happened about 14,000 years ago. Sea levels rose 65 feet in 400 years. It was a nonlinear sea level rise event. That's about 16 feet every 100 years.
Right.
We're assuming we're only going to see 4 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. People have no concept of how serious this problem is.
That's
and
true.
Like you said, they don't want to look at it. So how do we get them to wake up?
I don't know. All I can do is play Cassandra, and I agree with you. I mean, one of the things I noticed was that in the newspapers and in the climate change assessments, everything continues to happen more rapidly than in the worst-case scenario. So, yes, we could have sea level rise, drought conditions well beyond what we imagine. Maybe far sooner than in a century, maybe in 10 years, things are going to be horrendous. We have not lived through one of these planetary tipping points. You know, one of the things I sometimes hear is, well, Bill, you know, climate change is probably not caused by humans. It's a natural cycle. That's partially true in that, you know, something like half the methane may come from things like natural decomposition and termite mounds, half of the nitrous oxide from soil and from the oceans. But I say, so what? You know, we would be just as dead. And we certainly don't want to give ourselves license to do everything the termites do.
Wayne, thank you so much for the call. And when in talking about, you know, where people attribute climate change to, even people who are not climate change deniers. I mean, one thing about reading your book is it just reminded me of all the kind of contributors that are, I think most of us, we go coal-fired power plants, right? Coal-fired power plants, that's one of them. Maybe, you know, too much driving, car culture, that's contributing to it. But, you know, you talk about cement, right? The role cement as ubiquitous as you can get. And of course, part of car culture as well, but it's more than that.
That's right. Yeah, cement is one of the so-called big five materials, which actually use the majority of all industrial energy. Let's see. There's cement, paper, steel, plastic, and aluminum. We really haven't figured out how to manufacture those more efficiently.
Yep, that's a huge part, and this is really the world we live in. Where we're sitting right now, these materials are all around us. I'm going to go next to Peter in Marin. Welcome to Peter. Welcome, Peter, to your call.
Thank you for taking my call, and I'm sorry I missed the first 30 minutes of the program, and maybe you've covered this.
Jump right in.
I'm a physician. I got involved with the anti-nuclear movement right after Three Mile Island. Jumped on that bandwagon, protested Diablo Canyon, etc. But now I'm a climate activist, and I'm terrified of what's going on with climate because I think it can end our civilization. I was at COP21 in Paris 2 years ago where I heard the top climatologists in the world, including James Hansen and his colleagues, begging to not shut down operating nuclear plants because they'd be replaced with gas-fired plants, and begging for more R&D into next-generation nuclear plants, which are much safer, burn spent fuel, etc. Maybe you've covered this already, but what bothers me is the lack of proportionality in our fear. People are afraid of radiation. It's terrifying. Fukushima was terrifying. And we're worried about a marginal increase in cancer, mutations, and that sort of thing. And yet here we are burning fossil fuels and risking a mass extinction. And that to me is like completely, the proportions are a no-brainer. We have to have nuclear.
Peter?
And we have to shut down the carbon economy.
Hold on with us. I want to hear from Bill Vollman and then see if you want to follow up.
Great, thanks.
Okay, yeah, you know, Peter, you have a point. The fact is that what happened at Fukushima and Chernobyl is going to have serious consequences for a long time, and I wish I could say that nuclear was the way to go. I actually think that there's far more hope in solar than in nuclear, and that when you talk to the people at Fukushima who can never go back to their homes, when you think about all the tritium and strontium that is coming into the Pacific Ocean today, and maybe for decades more, and you imagine many, many more nuclear plants with lots and lots of nuclear error, it's not at all clear that it's a good idea. The fact is that all four of the major fuels are bad ideas. That's the terrible truth.
Peter, go ahead.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
I can't wait to get my hands on your book.
Oh, thank you.
And tell me where to get it. In bookstores?
It should be. I hope so.
Okay. Well, what about next generation, the small modular reactors, thorium, et cetera, which seem a lot more stable. They're not going to melt down. They don't produce plutonium bombs and stuff like that. And we're looking at a world where we're now at 409 parts per million CO2. We're heading for 500 or 1,000 ppm in a world that's 7 degrees centigrade hotter. That was when the dinosaurs lived on the Earth. And how is civilization supposed to survive that?
I'll tell you what. It's far worse than we imagine. If we were to cease all of our emissions today, over the next 1,000 years, the CO2 already in the atmosphere would continue to warm the planet something like 8 times more than it will in the next 100. It will still be increasing temperatures and raising sea levels 7,000 or 8,000 years from now. And so, yes, it's a terrible problem. But, you know, when I talked to the officials at TEPCO and said, well, what about these new next-generation nuclear reactors? What do you think? If anybody would be behind those, they would. And they said, well, we don't know. They haven't been tested. And that's the problem with nuclear, that we rush things into production that have not been tested or that have been tested only to very, very narrow tolerances that we trust will not be exceeded, and then we run into terrible problems. So we're in a bad situation, and I think solar is a better solution than nuclear.
Peter, thank you so much for the call. If you'd like to join the conversation here on Your Call today, we're talking about climate change, our civilization, and how we live and how we accept our responsibility in this unfolding tragedy for future generations and for the planet. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And Bill Volman is going to be speaking tonight at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park from 7:30 to 8:30, if you'd like to go and meet him and listen to him there. Also, tomorrow evening, he will be at East Bay Booksellers. That is in Oakland on College Avenue at 7 p.m. Either place, you can also get his new book, No Immediate Danger, which is volume one of his two-part Carbon Ideology series. Bill, you were talking a bit about solar as a hopeful technology. And actually, I have an email somewhat related to that subject.
Oh, good.
Which is the role of hope in climate change. Trish asks, what does Mr. Volman think about the role of hope in dealing with climate change? For me, the only way to deal with this existential threat is to do things to try to address it. Working with Citizens Climate Lobby, I feel like I can do something as a citizen to get a hold on climate. And returning all the dividends to households protects people from the inevitable rise in prices and at least some of the economic disruption. I think there's a little something that got cut off here. I believe it's related to carbon taxes is my guess.
Okay.
So talk about the role of hope in taking on something as huge as this and, as you say, things that something that's already so far down the road in many ways.
That's right. You know, well, Trish, I came to the solar chapter of my book very, very fuddy-duddy and out of date. You know, back in the 1970s, I helped to solarize a dairy barn, and I thought, well, efficiencies are still somewhat low. Maybe things are a little better. And I hired an expert from Georgia Tech to read and correct that chapter. And he said, Bill, things are so much better than you could imagine. Right now, you know, thanks to our president, we might be thinking a little bit about North Korea. And this guy at Georgia Tech said, if you were to set aside a solar reserve about the size of North Korea, with currently available solar technology, you could power the entire world. And we tend to think that it's impossible to have better than 100% efficiency. Our coal plants generally are only about one-third efficiency. The same thing with the nuclear plants.
Can you just explain what, in that context, what does efficiency mean? What's the, when you say one-third, what's the three and what's the one?
Well, consider spinning the turbine in a coal-powered plant. There's a certain amount of energy inside a pound of coal, something like 12,500 BTUs is the West Virginia Coal Association average. That's like per pound. A BTU is the amount of energy in a match tip. So if you could take all of those BTUs and turn them into energy, you would be doing fairly well. But in fact, two-thirds of those BTUs end up being wasted with necessary thermodynamic losses. Once the water is heated up into steam to turn the turbines, then that steam has to be captured and cooled down again. There's just no way to use all of that energy in the coal. And something similar happens with the turbines in a nuclear power plant. The heat given off by that irradiating fuel similarly is subject to about a two-thirds loss. But it's theoretically possible with photovoltaic cells to have greater than 100% efficiency. Strange as it may seem, there might be a way to take a photon and have it split into two photons. If we could somehow have solar batteries or use solar to store electricity in some other kind of batteries that we could put in, say, even to power our vehicles and planes, we might be able to get down to 0% emissions from electric power.
That is Bill Volman, our guest today on Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Let's go to our next caller, Marie Louise in Palo Alto. Welcome, Marie Louise.
Thank you so much. Good morning. Yes,
good morning.
I guess I also want to say something about the nuclear power plants, because all of us, I think, remember how very inexpensive, how very cheap they were going to be in every way, and how cheap the power was going to be that we got from there. And yesterday in San Francisco Chronicle, there was an article about shutting down Diablo Canyon, and that it's going to take years, because everything is, of course, so full of, can't think of the word right now, but they're still full of nuclear reaction. So everything has to be soaked in special containers, and anyway, it's going to take a very long time.
You're right.
And so I would just want to really hope that somewhere on this earth there are some people who would like to remind us of the price for building these power plants, and then the price when something goes wrong. You know, because if we want to think in money, that is, which, you know, I prefer not to do just that. But anyway, I'm so glad for what you're doing. Thank you so much. And I'm all for solar.
Oh, well, thank you. And, if I could add one thing to what you've said. One of the great tricks of these resource industries is to say, oh, you know, the nuclear or the coal or the oil or whatever is really, really cheap. And sometimes it is if you only think about the building cycle and the use cycle. But if you've ever seen a mountaintop removal mine in West Virginia, where everybody's drinking water is acidified so their teeth rot, that's not something that the coal company is going to pay for. If you think about the final cost of dealing with the horrific mess at Fukushima, there's no way that that is not going to way counterbalance the savings and the cheapness of nuclear power when those reactors were running. It's really not, a fair accounting.
Thank you, Marie Louise, for your call. I want to just go back to something that Trish raised in her email that we didn't get to address, and that is the idea of a carbon fee or carbon tax to make renewables more competitive.
I'm not an economist. I don't understand that stuff. I would have no problem paying a carbon tax. The question is, what does that tax go to? So often, you know, the government taxes us for one thing and then takes the money and uses it for something else. So I would want to be sure that tax actually went into solar and into power plant efficiency. They say that whenever metal is liquefied to turn into sheet metal, about half of that metal is wasted and has to be re-liquefied later. So if a carbon tax, for instance, were to go toward helping those sheet metal manufacturers retool, that would be a valuable thing. But I want to know where it goes.
I think it's important that we talk about what the results, not just like what would be the macroeconomic results of that, but where I think in terms of trying to put that forward to the public, that question is probably a common sense one many people ask. And I just want to point out that Trish in her email said those dividends should go back to protect people from the inevitable rise in prices and at least some of the economic disruption caused by it. That's what she's calling for. So
that sounds reasonable.
Got another email here from Catherine, who wrote to yourcall@kalw.org, and she says, "Dear Mr. Volman, how much is aviation activity contributing to climate change? I included not only the discretionary and business travel, which has become so common, but the military aviation, as well as crop dusting, etc. I have heard, and is this correct, that flying is the single most polluting thing that any individual can do in terms of personal contribution to greenhouse gases. Lovely to hear you. I've long admired your thoughtful and varied work."
Oh, well, thank you, Catherine. And yes, I have several friends who have given up flying. And there is an argument that that is the single most valuable thing you can do. You burn more carbon flying than you do driving. Is that enough? Probably not. And if you were to completely live off the grid, Catherine, and eat all your food raw, only walk somewhere, it wouldn't be enough to stop global warming.
Let's go to our next caller, which is Bill in Cupertino. Bill, talking here with Bill Volman. Two Bills getting together here.
Why not?
The book, No Immediate Danger, Volume 1 of Carbon Ideologies. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I have a question and then a real short comment, but my
yes.
question is this. Is not too long ago, there were seals up in north of Alaska someplace that they were actually, they found mass a good quantity of seals dying. They were bleeding from the mouth and so forth. And some people thought that it was because of the contaminated water from Fukushima just circling and coming this up that way up north and then traveling down to California. But what, do you believe that the death of all these seals and other animals up north was because of the water bringing that contaminated water from Japan? That's my question, and my comment is this, is I do believe in cause and effect and karma and so forth, and I know that what happened in Japan was terrible, and I wouldn't wish that on anybody, but when a nation goes, sends its whale fishing vessels out in the ocean to kill harmless whales, the cry of pain and suffering of those animals, I think, is transmuted into the water, and that's transmuted every other place in the on Earth, and Mother Earth doesn't like that. That Mother Earth is about preserving and protecting everything, and it's all cause and effect. And if we stopped harming and creating such destruction to the animals and the environment, then I think it doesn't come back as karma to human beings. And that's my comment. And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you so much. Bye bye.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Yeah, if Mother Earth is conscious, then yeah, I imagine that she is quite angry with us and she's going to punish us. My guess is that the seals who were bleeding from the mouth were not bleeding from the mouth from the radiation, because when I was in Fukushima, I never saw any evidence of animals dying there from the radiation or even being sick. Although I did see what looked like a mutant butterfly, and Greenpeace said there are mutant butterflies there. So my guess is that even if the seals were eating lots and lots of bottom-feeding fish off of the coast of Okuma or one of these other places at Fukushima, they probably all wouldn't be dying like that. It could easily be some other environmental cause.
So, Bill Volman, we're running short on time here. The program is coming to a close, but I wanted to get a question that came in from a caller who wanted to know. So we know about aviation and flying being something that contributes a lot to greenhouse gases. Do you have any data about, say, going on a cruise ship, that kind of thing? Someone wanted to know specifically about that. And if not, we understand.
Well, I don't, but most likely they're going to be burning a lot of diesel or some other kind of oil. If you're curious, if you look in Volume 2, I prepared some tables to show how harmful burning 1 gallon of oil or diesel is.
So that's coming up in the second volume of this book. Talk a little bit about what – so in this book you give a – in this first volume you give a primer about – this whole kind of carbon ideologies question, the whole range of technologies that we've developed in our society that draws on, that depends on them, that need, has a sense of need for them, and talking about nuclear power and its effects on Fukushima. What's coming up in the next volume?
Well, then I get into the specific carbon-based fuels. And one conclusion that I came to there is that most of the people who make their lives working with these fuels are not doing anything wrong. I have benefited from coal and nuclear and all these other fuels, and I'm not going to say, oh, what villains the West Virginia coal miners are. They have felt very abandoned and disrespected for decades, and I would like to thank them and compensate them and help them build all American solar collectors that they can sell.
We are speaking with William Vollmann. He's author of the new book, No Immediate Danger. You can see him tonight at Kepler's in Menlo Park at 7:30 p.m. Also tomorrow evening at the bookstore East Bay, East Bay Booksellers at 5433 College Avenue in Oakland at 7 p.m. All that information is at our website, yourcallradio.org. Earlier in the hour, Bill, you mentioned Thoreau. And actually, I hope you don't mind if I quote back something from your book, quote that you make from Thoreau in the book.
Why not?
You say, Thoreau called for books, quote, such as an idle man cannot read and a timid one would not be entertained by, which even make us dangerous to existing institutions. Such I call good books. And in reading this book, I wondered who you see this as being for. Who's your reader?
I would like to live up to that. I don't think the world owes me a living. I never have. And I'm not going to be disappointed if nobody reads my book. All I can do is my best. It's a very, very complicated web of cause that we find ourselves experiencing the effect from. And all I could do was try to do my duty as a citizen to delineate some of that web. And that's all I can say.
Well, Bill Vollmann, it's been great to spend the hour with you. I really appreciate you coming in to the studio here and being part of this conversation with our listeners.
Oh, thank you for your kindness.
Great to have you. And I do want to remind folks, you can see William Vollmann this evening at Menlo Park's Kepler's Books at 7:30 p.m. and tomorrow at Oakland's East Bay Booksellers at 7 p.m. He'll be there talking about his new book, No Immediate Danger, Volume 1 of Carbon Ideologies. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back on Wednesday. You can always listen to the show later at yourcallradio.org, and we always welcome your show ideas and feedback at yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to producer Malihe Razazan for today's program, also to David Latulipe, who is at the board, and Phil Hartman, our chief engineer. I'm Matt Martin. You've been listening to Your Call. Thanks so much.